This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. In Iraq today, American troops fought insurgents in the streets of downtown Baghdad, while U.S. warplanes struck the Baghdad neighborhood of Sadr City, where battles between Shiite militiamen loyal to the rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr continue. Meanwhile, American forces bombed a hideout in Fallujah suspected of belonging to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the terrorists believed responsible for the beheadings of several Americans. All this is happening 6,000 miles from Washington, but it hits home every day for the families of the thousands of American servicemen and women fighting in Iraq. And it's a critical issue faced every day by members of President Bush's administration. Today on Talk of the Nation, we'll speak with the highest-ranking military officer in the U.S. General Richard Myers is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In that role, he's the president's principal military advisor. General Myers will be joining us in a few minutes, a bit later in the show. We want to hear your questions and concerns about U.S. military strategies and goals in Iraq. But first, Eric Westervelt joins us here in Studio 3A. He's NPR's national security correspondent. Hi, Eric.
Good to be here, Joe.
So, what's the biggest problem facing General Myers in Iraq right now? Is it the domestic insurgents? Is it the foreign fighters? Is it stabilizing the country? Is it finding troops to fight in Iraq? What's he worrying about these days?
Well, I think your introduction highlighted the key problem that remains, and that is the insurgencies, plural. You talked about fighting in a predominantly Shiite neighborhood, the slum of Sadr City, as well as airstrikes on the Sunni insurgent stronghold of Fallujah, west of Baghdad, and the Sunni heartland known as the Sunni Triangle. It's those dual insurgencies that continue, and by some estimates continue to grow in strength in key areas, that remain the challenge for U.S. military forces and the fledgling Iraqi security forces. We all know that it's been a troubled path to get Iraqi security forces up and running, trained and equipped and ready for prime time, so to speak, to actually take the lead in key military operations. And that's going to continue to be the challenge as they U.S. forces take the lead in battling the insurgents that continue to make Iraq, in large areas, unstable.
You know, the term insurgents, it seems it's a kind of an umbrella term, and I guess it's anybody right now can be called an insurgent who's fighting against the U.S. coalition and the provisional Iraqi government. But can you parse this at all? Are there any, are there insurgents that have a military goal, insurgents that have a political goal? How does that break down?
Well, it is complicated, and I think U.S. military commanders and intelligence officials have struggled throughout the 18 months since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein to really get a clear picture of just who the insurgents are. They do know that there are a significant number of former regime elements. These are former officials in Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, many of them intelligence officers and military folks who are trained in explosives and in other military tactics. And by all indications, they are the majority of the leading insurgencies certainly in the Sunni heartland. We're talking about parts of Baghdad, Fallujah, Ramadi, these key Sunni cities west of Baghdad. Interesting to note that they have not articulated anything close to a kind of a clear political agenda, which to many point out that they right now their agenda seems to be, you know, violence for violence's sake, an attempt to destabilize the interim Iraqi government, try to kick out U.S. forces, but they don't have a political wing or a political agenda that's been articulated. On the other hand, a different faction, these Shiite insurgents, many of them loyal to a young radical firebrand cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, they do have something of a fledgling political wing. Sadr, several times during the last year and a half, has tried to reinvent himself from a rebel fighter to a statesman and politician. He seems to have been tried to do that again now that fighting in Najaf in recent months has subsided. It's a key Shiite city south of Baghdad. They are trying to have a political wing, and it's still unclear, Joe, how much they can be brought into the political fold as Iraq moves towards elections. But clearly fighting today and in recent days in the Sadr City slum of 5 million in Sadr City is a troubling trend because it shows that the Sadr problem, so to speak, is still with U.S. forces and has not been rectified.
But you raise an interesting point. It can't be strictly a military problem in Iraq if you've got one group of people that you can actually talk to and perhaps negotiate with, and another group that's just interested in destabilizing, perhaps for the sake of destabilizing, in the hopes that you'll just go away. I mean, how does an army and how does General Myers, you know, control a situation like that? It's not just, I mean, it's got to have a political aspect to it as well as a military aspect.
Well, sure. I think General Myers has said for a long time, and many Pentagon officials and White House officials have said, that it can't just be a military solution to the Iraq insurgency. It has to also be a dual-tracked political and economic agenda that tries to bring some political stability to Iraq and economic prosperity and jobs. I think they've had some success against the Shiite Sadr forces in places like Najaf and Kufa in trying to craft a political settlement and solution, although there obviously has been intense fighting in those areas. They've also put out some economic and political carrots to try to alleviate the tensions. But in the Sunni heartland, particularly in Fallujah and Ramadi and Samarra and these other areas, in the Sunni triangle, the political economic track hasn't worked. And I think in many ways, Iraqi and American forces have tried that. They've failed and they're fed up. And the only option remaining to many analysts is a military one. That's primarily going to these areas that are de facto controlled by insurgent groups, and in the case of Fallujah, some foreign fighters and terrorists, and take them out and regain the semblance of control of those cities for the interim government before January elections.
So there's more, I mean, there's quite a bit more than just a policing action that's going to be needed to put this country back on some sort of stable footing. There's still a lot more, you know, traditional military fighting that has to go on, don't you think?
Well, the general in charge of the Middle East for the U.S., General John Abizaid, the commander of U.S. Central Command, just said this weekend, quote, "I think we're going to have to fight our way through the elections. There will be a lot of violence between now and then," end quote. So I think in many ways people in Iraq and military officials are bracing for the potential for increased violence before the elections, and certainly potentially large-scale military operations done jointly with Iraqi forces to go out and clean out some of these, you know, so-called no-go areas that have become insurgent zones.
We're still waiting on General Myers, who should be here any moment. But in the meantime, we'll take a call. Our number here is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's take a call from George in Wilmington, Delaware. George, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Mostly I was trying to find out an answer here to at least the Sunday's New York Times, which kind of hinted around that there was a lot of permanent base building going on. And I heard numbers of 23, 24 bases. This is a rather large investment. And when I think of permanent bases, I think this is for years. Then there's also the other thing that in the past I raised that would seem to reinforce this is that we are to be the beacon of democracy and good school building for the whole Middle East. I'd like to have, particularly a senior person in the administration, confirm kind of what is the long-term plan here with regard. I mean, we're looking at elections in January, and supposedly within a year, a government can come back and say, thank you very much, U.S., now leave.
Yeah, okay. George, interesting point. Maybe we'll be able to put that to General Myers when we're able to reach him. But, Eric, are you familiar at all with these bases that George was talking about?
Well, not specifically the 24 bases he's referring to, but certainly there's been a debate and questioning about what is the long-term presence of U.S. military forces in Iraq once the Iraqi government gets on its feet and the insurgency's defeated, if they are. What will be the long-term U.S. military presence? Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has said publicly several times that he doesn't have plans to establish permanent bases there. But obviously playing a lead role in training Iraqi security forces, border patrols, and police, etc. NATO is playing some of a role, but the U.S. right now is the lead role. The U.S. is going to have a presence certainly in Iraq for the foreseeable future and for a very long time. But to his other point about the larger issue in the Middle East, certainly U.S. officials have seen the invasion of Iraq, the toppling of Saddam, as part of a larger effort to help bring about democracy in the Middle East and throughout the broader region. Clearly, many analysts point out that there isn't a history of democracy in that area, and it's going to continue to be a tough going. This is an area marked by authoritarianism and dictatorship for a very long time, including in Iraq.
Yeah, and it's going to be I've read, obviously I haven't been there as you have, but it does seem like the concept of democracy, the principles of democracy, the behavior of democracy is something that may not just sit comfortably on the people there. But
yeah, I think it's a good point. I was interested in the fact the last time I was in Iraq, people very much yearned for a strong man. It was, of course, not the kind of despotic nastiness of Saddam Hussein, but they very much wanted interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi to show a strong hand and to crush the insurgents and to exercise, his authority. So I think there's a history of that in Iraq, and they're still looking in many ways for Alawi to exercise his authority and build legitimacy as Iraq moves towards elections.
We're still waiting on General Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is going to be joining us to talk about his impressions of the situation in Iraq and other topics related to the American military presence both there and perhaps throughout the rest of the world. I think we have time for one more call perhaps before he comes on. Let's go to Max in Concord, California. Max in Concord, California, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is specifically regarding the elections in Iraq. I'd like, and if possible, if the general could comment when he shows up, how do they plan to safely conduct these elections when they can't safely conduct military operations? And to the point of having a tradition, democracy, I'd like maybe to discuss the difference between, say, occupied Germany and Japan. They both were democratic states.
All right.
Prior to the end of the war, yeah.
Well, it's Max, you raise an interesting point. I think that would have to be one of the questions that we'll put to the general. Eric, before he comes on, though, I'm wondering if you can anticipate another question that I think he'll have to face, and that is manpower. First of all, the question of are there enough troops in Iraq now, and the second question, which is if he needs more, can he get hold of them?
First, to Max's question about elections, obviously,
okay.
that's a key one, and we will get to it with General Myers. And certainly in the last few days, Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and others have pointed out that they will be imperfect elections and may not be in every part of the country, but they will go ahead with elections.
Eric, I've just found out that General Myers is here, and so let me welcome General Myers. He's joining us from his office and at the Pentagon. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, sir.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Eric.
Hi, General. Hi, General. General, we only have about a minute before we have to take a quick break, but maybe you can briefly characterize the situation in Iraq today from your point of view, and of course we can pick up your answer after we take the break if you want more time.
Well, it's clearly a challenging environment, but I would characterize it as one of progress. I mean, we're still marching towards elections. We're focusing on training Iraqis to handle their own security situation, both the police and the army and what we call the Iraqi National Guard, which is not like our National Guard, but a force that will help basically the police or the army fill in. And we think we're making some progress. Obviously, since sovereignty, we predicted it has happened that the insurgents, both the former regime elements, the Ba'athist, as well as Zarqawi's network, are probably pretty desperate to keep elections from happening because it'll be that inertia that's going to propel this country to democracy, and they want to do anything they can do to stop.
General, as I warned you, we do have to take a quick break. I promise we'll come right back. Please stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Eric Westervelt will stay with us too. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Our guest today is General Richard Myers, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Myers came up through the ranks during his 35-year career in the Air Force, becoming Chairman of the Joint Chiefs in October 2001. He's speaking with us from his office at the Pentagon, just across the river from Washington in Arlington, Virginia. Also with us here in Studio 3A is NPR's national security correspondent, Eric Westervelt. And General, just before the break, you were giving us what I guess you would characterize as a progress report and indicating that progress was reasonably positive. Do you want to continue with that? Or?
Right. And when I say reasonably positive, I mean we are marching towards elections. The prime minister, when he was here last week in Washington, seems very confident that the country will be ready for elections. I think our ambassador over there thinks as well. But as General Abizaid put it on one of the Sunday morning shows, you know, he said we're going to fight our way through into elections, which is, as you look at democracies and how they are born, that a lot of them are born out of violence, and violence continues for a while as the democratic ideals and tenets take hold. And so we're going to see that in Iraq, but we're going to see it even probably more violent because, A, it's a violent part of the world, and, two, there are people there that simply don't want Iraq to show this kind of progress. The Zarqawis of the world, the ones we think are responsible for a lot of the beheadings, proud to show those beheadings on video. The last thing they want is a democratic state in the middle of the Middle East. And it would be so opposed to their way of thinking that my view is they're pulling out all the stops. And it's an act of desperation. They do have some capability. They're doing desperate acts, but they're not without their resources. And anytime you can convince a suicide bomber to take a car loaded with explosives into a marketplace and blow up innocent Iraqis, they'll do it, and they can do it, and we can stop some. We can't stop them all. By the way, I might just mention we find a lot more improvised explosive devices, to include vehicle-borne explosive devices, than go off. But the ones that go off have their effect, and you just simply can't stop them all.
Well, General, as I mentioned, my colleague Eric Westervelt, who's NPR's national security correspondent, is here, and I'm going to see if Eric wants to jump in here with a couple of questions.
General, thanks for joining us today.
You bet, Eric.
My question is, you mentioned the Zarqawi network. We know that he's active in Fallujah and Baghdad and is a terrorist who's causing extreme damage in Iraq. But your commander in the Middle East, John Abizaid, said this weekend that he thought foreign fighter insurgents in Iraq are a minority, numbering only about 1,000. I'm wondering if you share that assessment, that the insurgency in Iraq is largely comprised of Iraqis. This is a homegrown problem of former regime elements as opposed to foreign fighters.
Right, and I talked before General Abizaid spoke to the media. Of course, I speak to General Abizaid on average once a day, sometimes several times a day, depending on what the subject is and what the tempo of events is. But I don't think I'd be going on a limb if I said he would say that the biggest threat inside Iraq are the former regime elements, the Ba'athist, and that's why you see the violence where you see it. It's where they typically came from. To work in the Baghdad bureaucracy or wherever, and that's the so-called triangle there that goes out from Baghdad up to the west to Ramadi and up to the north to Crit, or maybe even as far as Mosul and back down. And Eric, you know that well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where a lot of the violence is. But I don't think you can discount the seriousness of the Zarqawi network as well. Small in number, probably being fed by other jihadists that want to come in, being facilitated by the fact that the borders are difficult to control and that there are neighbors that aren't being particularly helpful in trying to control those borders, particularly Syria I'm talking about. Mm. And they're the ones, we think, for the most part, are doing the suicide operations. There's not much evidence to support Iraqis involved in suicide operations. It's counter their culture. As you know, they've had a relatively secular society, so this doesn't compute that it would be Iraqis. I think we know of one Iraqi in a vehicle-borne explosive improvised device, but the rest have been probably outsiders. So while small in number, they fight bigger than that number, and they're the ones responsible, as I said, for most of the beheadings. So in terms of impact, not just numbers of incidents, but the impact that those individual incidents have, you can't discount a Zarqawi network, and this has been reported and I think is pretty accurate. Zarqawi is an al-Qaeda associate, not part of al-Qaeda, but there's some hints that that they may be trying to cement that relationship a little more formally.
So small in number but effective, General. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you link the counterinsurgency effort in Iraq to the larger war on terror, given the relatively limited number and, as you point out, still effective number of foreign fighters in Iraq? How do you connect the two there?
You connect them when you go back to the extremism that we're dealing with, particularly, well, in particular, al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda is, I think most folks know, is a type of extremism that wants to go back to the caliphate that's stretched basically from parts of Indonesia all the way through some parts of Central Asia and through the Middle East and through North Africa. And their goal would be to institute this caliphate again, where their form of Islam, this extremist form of Islam, would rule. To get there, they've got to topple some governments. They've got to get rid of Western influence, particularly U.S. influence. And that's how the dots are connected. That is what is going on. That is what was going on in Afghanistan. That is why Zarqawi and his associates are so dangerous inside Iraq. And we see it with other al-Qaeda plots throughout the region, some of which have been thwarted, some have not. Riyadh, Morocco, Madrid, those kind of operations where people who want this caliphate to return, and their extreme view, let me enforce that, the extreme view of Islam that they have, trying to, as some people said, hijack, I don't like the term, but hijack the religion, but they're trying to use that as a way to go back in time to the 6th century or before and establish a way that most people who don't want to be in servitude probably wouldn't agree with, the majority of Muslims.
General, it's Joe Palka again. If I can come back to the situation in Iraq, you were saying, a couple questions, you were saying that it's a political, I mean, the politicians at least for now are indicating that they expect elections to go forward as planned. Is it going to be a decision ultimately that they make and you'll have to do the best you can, or at some point will you have to say to them, we can't let you do this because it's too dangerous a situation?
Well, I think it'll be a combination of factors. Clearly, the interim government is the ones that would have the primary responsibility for this. We cannot forget the United Nations, who will be deeply involved in the political process. It was the United Nations, after all, and I think it was Brahimi who helped set up this interim Iraqi government. And now we have a new UN leader in Iraq, and the UN team coming in here in the next month or so to help with the election process. And so I think it would probably be a combination of heads that would go together to say, are we ready, are we not ready, and what needs to be done. Clearly, with my head on, with the military head on, what we've got to do is ensure that we continue to train as expeditiously as possible Iraqi security forces, and that once they're trained and equipped, that there is a leadership chain that the Iraqis can see all the way up from their unit up to the national level. And there are some holes in that chain today that need to be filled, and the Iraqi government's busily about trying to do that. But that they have to have a chain of command so they know who they're responding to and what they're fighting for and what their mission is. And we have about 100,000 Iraqi security forces today. By January, we think we'll have 145,000. So that we're going to focus very heavily on that ball. And then we're going to have to focus on the security in those areas where it's very tough right now, the Fallujahs, Samarra, perhaps some other cities, to ensure that the people there have an opportunity to go to the polls in a secure way.
We're talking with General Richard Myers, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I'm joined here in Studio 3A with Eric Westerveld, NPR's National Security Correspondent. Eric, you had a question.
General, to follow up on what you were saying, some of these areas controlled by, at least de facto on the ground, controlled by insurgents like Fallujah, Ramadi, Samarra, where there's a strong insurgent presence, are you going to have to go in there and clear these places out before viable elections can take place in January? And if so, don't you risk also alienating the local population, as civilians, of course, are inevitably going to be caught up in some of the fighting? How do you mitigate that risk of civilian casualties, or is that simply inherent in any counterinsurgency operation that might take place in these areas?
Eric, that not just because I know you, but that is an excellent question. And it's one, I think, that is not always understood by the casual observer, and that is that any solution in Fallujah, Samarra, Najaf, as we've seen recently, Ramadi, has to be, in the end, a political solution. I mean, there is nothing that can be imposed by force that's going to be lasting in character. So there has to be a political end to this. That's what it's all about. So the partnership that we have, we being the coalition forces with the Iraqis, has to be very tight as we look at the political objectives and then how we're going to achieve them. We have really worked hard since the beginning of combat to make sure this is a humane a process as war can be, knowing that war is not humane, knowing it's just the opposite of that. It's a terrible scourge. But knowing that, we have worked very hard to minimize civilian casualties, and this is no time to change that philosophy. And as you mentioned, Eric, you could be successful militarily and create a lot more enemies through that action, at least successful temporarily. So all that has to go into the calculus as the Prime Minister and his cabinet, as General Casey, our coalition leader, military leader in Iraq, think through the options that they have for various places. And yet, other things you have to put in the calculus is that Iraqis do respect force, and they respect people who use force. Mm-hmm. And they don't respect weakness. All those sorts of things have to go into the calculus, and then the political leadership and the military leadership have to agree to a plan of action and take that action. I'll only say, not to get ahead in terms of future operations, but the situation in Fallujah cannot remain status quo. Everybody knows that. It's unacceptable. And Ramadi is kind of in the middle there. We'll work through that with the Iraqis in the lead and try to do what's right, try to do what's as humane as possible. At the same time, I might mention on the humane part, there are obviously the Sarkawi and his associates, they have to be captured or otherwise dealt with because we cannot leave them in the in Iraq. They have to be dealt with in any case. There are probably former regime elements who are taking up arms against the coalition that might, given a political future and given an economic future, might decide to be part of a new Iraq. So, yeah, it's a very delicate balance, and that's what the folks over there are trying to balance, and we're trying to help them do that.
You make a good point about any military solution having to work with a political and economic progress as well, but I'm wondering, the Sunni insurgents in places like Fallujah have not articulated a political or agenda and plan, and without revealing any operational details, which we know you won't get into, won't U.S. and Iraqi forces simply have to clear out places like Fallujah? Because there don't seem to be any positive signs of a political solution in Fallujah in particular.
Well, I would say there have been attempts at a political solution, and you can be the judge whether or not you think they're successful, but there was a plan back earlier where we had the Fallujah Brigade and we had some cooperation with local government officials. But the officials in Fallujah now, not associated with the insurgents, want it over and done with. We know that. They're talking to their Iraqi counterparts. They're talking to U.S. military, and they want their city back, and they want to get on with business, much like the people in Najaf did. So I'm afraid in an unclassified forum, I just don't want to go too far here, but I will say this, that the use of force is never ruled out. That can always be part of the solution. I didn't want to give the impression that it's only political, but it's going to have to be a combination. It's going to have to be one that everybody involved in the problem is comfortable with. And I'm not going to get into hypothesizing on what you might see in Fallujah. I think that would be unfair to the troops on the ground over there.
We're talking with General Richard Myers, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from his office at the Pentagon, and Eric Westerveld is here with me in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Eric, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
General, I want to ask you a little bit about the training of Iraqi security forces. General David Petraeus said this weekend there are about 100,000 trained and equipped Iraqi police and soldiers ready to go. But I'm wondering, on the key issue of a chain of command, an Iraqi chain of command, do you see optimistic signs or troubling signs, given that, at least in one case, U.S. military officials had to arrest an Iraqi National Guard commander for ties to the insurgents, and there are reports today that in Samarra, some masked gunmen with ties to Zarqawi's network sort of rallied in downtown, and they were driving police pickup trucks, at least in some cases.
Well, it's true of any organization. It's true of the United States military. Every once in a while we find somebody in our midst that wants to sell secrets to the other side or otherwise misbehave in a way not consistent with our standards. I think that's what this vetting process will be, is a tough process inside Iraq, given their history, given the positions that some of these people have held formerly. But I do know, and having sat in on a conversation with Prime Minister Alawi when he was here last week and the Minister of Defense, Shalon, I do know that they're working, they understand this issue, they're working it very hard. They have a committee that's looking at a list of people and going through a vetting process. Like any vetting process, it will be imperfect. There will be people that will be cleared to do something, and later you'll find out, well, that was the wrong decision. But I think they can, by and large, come up with the people they need. There are certainly, given the numbers of Iraqis that are standing in line to become part of the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, that have been targeted, specifically targeted by Zarqawi and his groups and maybe the former regime elements with car bombs and so forth, that the enthusiasm is there to have a better Iraq. And I think that'll be true in the leadership. But we need to get on with it. It's something that needs to have priority, and we need to get on to it. But it is, after all, an Iraqi process that's going to have to get us there.
General, we've only got about a minute left. I want to ask one final question. You've sketched out a lot of things that have to be accomplished still. Do you see a conclusion to all this happening soon, or are we talking months, years, decades, what?
Well, I think it depends on what part we say is going to conclude when. This is a tough challenge. It's also an important challenge because of the reasons we talked about earlier. So I would say we're gonna have to stay the course, whatever it takes. I mean, this is very, very important. This threat of terrorism or extremism, really, using terror as a weapon, creating fear, is not something that this the free world can live with. It can be very damaging to us. We can just see the events after 9/11, how it shook our confidence a little bit. So we're going to have to deal with the Zarqawis of the world and other extremists that think they can shoot children in the back or explode car bombs in marketplaces and those sorts of things sooner or later. And now's the time. It's very important. It's important for the survival of our democracy, as far as I'm concerned. In fact, it's a big threat to our democracy. So whatever it takes, our resolve, we've got to be steadfast. We've got to see it through to the end.
Okay. General, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very much for your time today. You were getting to the end. I appreciate it.
I was getting to the end, but anyway, resolve. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining.
Richard Myers is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Eric Westervelt was here with me. We'll be right back with a true genius. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.